Baseball is in full swing. NBA playoffs are heating up, and your NFL team is gearing up for training camp. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
I'm Listening is Odyssey's commitment to mental health conversations. If you or someone you know is struggling with thoughts of suicide, depression, anxiety, or mental illness, help is available. Call or text 988 to reach the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. That's 988.
Welcome to Odyssey Conversations, the state of the environment. I'm John Little.
And I'm Kristen Diaz with KRLD in Dallas. And tonight, we're taking a deep dive into something that affects everyone in one way or another, regardless of where you live. When you say the word environment, it can mean a lot of things to a lot of different people. But for some, it's as basic as air, water, and land, and where we live with animals and plants.
Now, for others, it's much more complex and much more passionate as well. It seems like every day we hear about another initiative to save the planet in one way or another, cut down on pollution maybe, or make products that are carbon neutral. We hear about sustainability and conservation as well.
And tonight we're going to be looking into everything from EVs to solar panels to what scientists can learn about the environment from the recent solar eclipse. And of course, the ever-changing weather. It's all happening tonight on Odyssey Conversations, the state of the environment.
But Kristen, let's start with perhaps the most important conversation happening when you talk about the environment, the weather. We are joined now by Odyssey meteorologists Craig Allen, Dan Brunoff, and Tom Hale. Thank you all for joining us. We really appreciate it because between all three of you, I think it's safe to say you deal with pretty much every possible weather phenomenon imaginable, tornadoes to monster hail, super fog, earthquakes. One thing's for sure, there is no such thing as normal. Let's bring in Craig Allen right now. And Craig, first of all, why is weather important to the environment?
Over the last several years and over the last couple decades, actually, I have noticed a tremendous difference in my portion of the country across the Mid-Atlantic, the Northeast, New England, into the Ohio Valley. It has just been a remarkable change in intensity.
It does feel as though we've seen not only more intense, but also more frequent big weather events.
You're talking about dangerous and even sadly, in some cases, deadly conditions that have started to occur in a much greater frequency with each and every storm system that comes along here. Sure, we just get a day when there's just a shower or a thunderstorm, but it just seems like there is so much more to it over the last several decades around it. Well, I should say the last several years, and at least including to a decade or so of records that go on back.
Something that really scared me, and I don't scare easily, watching Hurricane Michael come rolling across the Gulf of Mexico a few years back, and it continued to increase in intensity all the way till it got on shore, hitting an Air Force base in Florida with winds of 177 miles an hour and going quickly from a 3 to a 5. And the Weather Service came out with a statement, and it was, if you don't evacuate now, we can't help you. And I've never read that statement before, but nowadays, I think Dan can concur, we're seeing more and more of those statements, including considerable damage and risk in our bulletins from the Weather Service.
You're listening to Odyssey Conversations, the state of the environment. I'm John Little, joined by Kristen Diaz, and we're talking with our Odyssey meteorologists, Craig Allen, Tom Hale, and Dan Brunoff. Dan, we hear a lot about climate change. In what ways are we seeing climate change play out in the weather?
With storms increasing in strength and frequency, droughts happening more frequently, wildfires seem to be happening more frequently. Yeah, the climate is changing some. And over the past 100 years, per decade since the turn of the century, since 1900, the planet has warmed about, we'll say, 0.16 degrees Fahrenheit, okay, per decade. So with the warming of the planet, we're still learning about how this will impact storms. Will desert areas become monsoonal areas and get more rain? Will the heavier rainy areas become drier as the planet warms slowly. Our technology is getting better and better, so we don't have an excuse not to be ready for this.
So, Tom, let's turn to you. Are climate and weather the same thing?
People have a great confusion as it relates to this. One of them is weather and climate are two completely different things. And so when people hear about issues of climate change, climate is weather calculated and averaged over years, whereas weather is something that happened today. And so if it's a cold day, it's easy to say there's no such thing going on as warming, and vice versa. That's a simple thing you need to not confuse, and it's easily done.
And Dan, I'd love to get your thoughts on this as well. Knowing the climate of an area, how does that help you with your forecasting?
Being in an area for an extended period of time, you know when you have your hiccups. Well, over time, you start to disagree with some of the data you're looking at because you've seen the same atmospheric conditions set up before and nothing has happened, or the same atmospheric conditions happen and there's a change in the path of the storm. So I've learned over time is I'm seeing these 14-day forecasts on some local markets. In my opinion, I don't think anybody should go out past 5 days.
I absolutely agree with you on that, Dan. And you will have more information that is more environmentally helpful to everybody who's listening to you, who's watching you out there, if you're telling them you better run to the basement or you better get prepared for flooding within the next 6 to 12 hours. There is no 5-day forecast or longer that remains the same every single day. It is inevitably going to change.
We hear terms like El Nino and La Nina, like those long-term weather patterns that we're in or that we're in for a season. What are we in right now, and what does that pattern mean for us?
We are coming off a very strong El Nino, and that made a very big difference again for East Coast systems. Snow was very limited once again for the mid-Atlantic states and the major cities along I-95. We did not even make double-digit snowfall for New York City for the second year in a row, which is quite remarkable, but I think is definitely a trend not just associated with El Nino, but with so many other factors. And this obviously will have a big effect on future forecasts and long-range forecasts and what it will mean in terms of the environment around here when you don't get as much snowfall. It means a lot to commerce and to industry that thrive on snow through the winter months.
So, Tom, what about the West Coast?
In this particular year, we had these large ridges off the West Coast of warm, moist air, and we had a blocking ridge across the United States, which kept the Alaskan and Canadian all the way up through the Arctic air bottled up. And so when it finally started coming down, it was like a slide. And in came the moisture from one side out of the Alaska Gulf. And the second thing was the cold air coming down along with it, just above it, combining, coming across the West Coast. Further south, because the air was much colder, it had been bottled up for so long through the winter that it had built up a lot. And so the West Coast just got hammered with enormous amounts of snow and with disturbances in that jet stream, one right after another.
Final question for you guys. Are there other ways, more unique ways, in which we may be seeing the effect of our weather and climate play out?
I think you could say this for all parts of the country, but around here, there are completely brand new insects. There are completely brand new types of trees, weeds, flowers, and the growing, I don't know if you've noticed, but the growing calendar, the growing season has shifted and become longer. And me personally, that to me is a very, very clear indication that we have definitely seen already a change in Earth as to what's happening with our climate change itself in terms of temperatures. I think we see a completely different type of situation setting up where different zones across the country are seeing more and more of severe things, mm-hmm. and they are seeing more and more new things added to their environmental conditions across the country.
Join us at Odyssey as we all do our one thing, together millions of things for our planet. Earth Day is April 22nd. When using heat-generating appliances like dishwashers and ovens in the spring and summer, use them in the evening and off-peak hours. This minimizes the effects of heat and saves on electric costs. When we each share one thing, it becomes 100 things, 1,000 things, 1,000,000 things for our planet. What's your one thing?
This is Kristen Diaz in Texas. No matter what state you're in, there are more cars, trucks, and SUVs on the road than ever before. But how many of them are electric? EV sales are down in the U.S., but why? Jeff Gilbert is in Detroit and continues our Odyssey Conversations, the state of the environment.
Environmental issues dominate the auto industry's agenda these days. Here in Detroit, carmakers are spending billions to transition to EVs while also dealing with a market that today wants the latest and greatest in pickups and SUVs. Well, carmakers can build electric vehicles, but they need people to buy them. This year, that's not been as easy as before. That's why you're seeing price cutting and carmakers changing plans. Joining us to navigate these issues, two people who really live this every day, Stephanie Brenly, Sam Abulsamid. Both are top auto analysts, Stephanie with S&P Global Mobility, Sam with Guidehouse Insights. Now, Stephanie, I just saw some numbers today from the Alliance for Auto Innovation. They count, and this seems a bit much to me, 114 EVs on the market at the end of last year. While it sounds a bit high, it still means there are a lot of new models out there, a lot coming. And how has this addition of new EVs impacted the market?
That does seem like a quite high number, although there are a number to choose from. And what that does for consumers is it gives choice in different segments for electric vehicles. One of the things that needs to happen for electric vehicles to get more popularity is to be in the segments that people live in. And they need to have more than one option. So if you've got a compact SUV electric vehicle, you need several of them in order to sort of grow that market. In the meantime, it's also complicated because consumers then have more choice, more nameplates. And there's a point where consumers can get a little bit fatigued by how many things they can consider.
And Sam, we're seeing a lot of discounting now. Why are we seeing so much?
Well, even though there's been a lot of new nameplates introduced over the last 3 years in the EV segment, one thing we haven't seen is very many affordable EVs. The vast majority of what we've got are at very high price points that are beyond the affordability of most consumers. Combined with the changes to the tax credit program that came with the IRA, a lot of vehicles that in 2022 would have been eligible for tax credits are no longer eligible because they're either not assembled in North America or they use battery components or materials sourced from other locations that the IRA explicitly prohibits. Manufacturers are having to adjust their pricing even though they haven't necessarily been able to adjust their costs of building these vehicles, but they're adjusting their pricing to try to get what they're building into the hands of consumers.
Go ahead, Stephanie.
The affordability issue, I think, is a key one. And I look at it, it's not the raw price necessarily. It's the price discrepancy between a comparably sized internal combustion engine vehicle. For example, Chevrolet's Equinox EV that's coming in a couple of 2 months or so will be give or take $5,000 more than a gas Equinox vehicle. That's where the affordability thing starts to come into play. If you're still at that, if you want a $35,000 electric vehicle, you can find one. But will it be in the shape and the size that fits your life? And it's still more expensive than a comparable internal combustion engine. And that discrepancy is one of the things that consumers are struggling with.
Sam, you wanted to talk about that?
Yeah. I agree with what Stephanie said on pricing. There's also the challenge of charging.
Yeah.
Over the last couple of years, as there have been more EVs out there, more people driving EVs, we've also at the same time been hearing a lot more reports from consumers of finding charging stations that don't work or not finding charging stations at all. And so I think a lot of people that might have been considering EVs over the last couple of years have maybe backed off and said, I'm going to wait a while until the charging infrastructure situation improves. This is one of the reasons why the industry has shifted over to from the CCS charging connector to the so-called NACS or J3400 connector that was designed by Tesla and done deals with Tesla to get access to the supercharger network, which has been much more reliable than any of the other public charging networks.
And I was going to bring up charging later, but we'll bring it in now since Sam brought it up. Stephanie, talk a little bit about what's happening. I mean, getting back to that report I quoted earlier from the Auto Alliance, and, you know, I think they like to throw out dramatic numbers, and this is dramatic. They say we need to install 437 chargers a day for the next 7 years to get to where we need to be. Yeah, you're kind of... groaning and squinting at that. But we do agree that we need a lot more chargers than we have. But how do you determine the sweet spot? Because most people with EVs do most of their charging at home. But when you go on the road, you need it. But often you only need it for a short period of time, unless, of course, you live in an apartment, which is a whole different thing. So it is so complex.
It's very complex. And then, you know, the charger, whether or not it has the right charging pace and all sorts of other things coming in, and how quickly can you build them? I look at the charging infrastructure development. It's going to take time. It's going to evolve. And part of it will be a little bit organic. You're trying to find the space of having the charging infrastructure available so people can adapt while not having something that's sitting there not used for 5 years. If we look at the development of the gas station, I mean, we're talking 40 years before you had a gas station that kind of looks like what we have today. And we had that settled in about 1955 or 1960. So the idea that we're going to suddenly get an infrastructure in the next 2 years and this is how it's going to happen, I think is a false narrative. I think that we have to understand that the infrastructure is going to take time to develop. It takes time to do permits. It takes time to lay cable. You can finance these things through a bunch of different ways, but, you know, even incentives and things like that, you know, the incentives don't actually put the shovel on the ground to dig up and put the cable in. These are just going to take time. And I think in that meantime as well, we are going to see consumers find different ways to work with charging than we expect. Exactly what they're going to do, I don't know yet, or else I would have solved it. But I do think that there's an opportunity that consumers behave a little bit differently than we expect.
And I want to segue to another subject before we finish, because we've got to talk a little bit about new federal emission standards. And Sam, you're an engineer, but I'm going to ask you to translate this into plain English, staying away from greenhouse gas emissions and cutting that. What is this going to mean for the average consumer?
It means the new emission standards mean that manufacturers will have to sell vehicles that are much more efficient and produce much less greenhouse gases than they do today. Part of that is that's actually going to require a range of electrification solutions across the spectrum. So whatever vehicles they sell that aren't battery electric vehicles are still going to have to have are predominantly going to have electrification of some sort, whether that is a traditional hybrid, a standard hybrid system, or a plug-in hybrid. I think towards the end of this decade, you will see very few new vehicles sold that don't have some degree of electrification as part of the powertrain.
And Stephanie, right now we're seeing a lot of hybrid sales. Are we moving in that direction as we get into the next decade when there's a lot of heavy lifting with these rules? Can we see car makers get to this without doing as many EVs as some environmentalists would like and shifting at least some of the burden to hybrids?
Some of the burden will shift to hybrids, but if we look at some of our forecasting and research, we expected there to be a lot more hybrids the second half of this decade, even before these requirements. What we are also seeing is consumers are finally used to hybrids after 25 years, and that automakers are now able to really package hybrids in a way that consumers don't feel like they have a big price penalty. It behaves pretty much like what they have, and it's very easy. For example, Honda CR-V, they would like to see 50% of their sales be hybrid. Well, if you have a consumer who comes in and wants an ICE engine vehicle, if you kind of shift them to that hybrid, they're going to be just as happy in most cases. And so I think we're seeing a little bit of that happen as well.
And Sam, final question goes to you before we wrap things up. The consumer is the big variable here. Could we get to a situation where we have a lot of vehicles out there that are great, they're environmentally friendly, but people aren't buying them?
That is certainly a potential, especially if the vehicles that are out there are beyond the affordability range of most consumers. We could end up in a situation where the number of people who can afford the vehicles is shrinking, and I mean, I think we've already been seeing that, and the overall new vehicle sales could end up declining just because people can't afford what is offered to them.
You're listening to Odyssey Conversations, the state of the environment. If you've missed any of our discussion, search for Odyssey Conversations on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. One city's need to find an advocate for Earth Day has now turned into an international organization. And coming up next, Odyssey's David Johnson talks with EarthX founder Trammell Crow as our Odyssey Conversations, the State of the Environment, continues.
Join us at Odyssey as we all do our one thing, together millions of things, for our planet. Earth Day is April 22nd. It's always good to recycle. Always recycle paper, bottles, and cans. Make sure to use the proper recycling bin at work and set up a container next to the trash to make recycling easy at home. When we each share one thing, it becomes 100 things, 1,000 things, 1,000,000 things for our planet. What's your one thing?
This is Odyssey Conversations, the state of the environment. I'm John Little. Thanks for joining us. Now David Johnson takes a deep dive with the founder of EarthX, Trammell Crow.
You know, it all started out, in 2010, started out as Earth Day Dallas. Trammell S. Crow was asked to take it over and turn it into something. He turned it into Earth Day Texas, which became EarthX, which became an enormous outdoor expo. And now it's become an enormous meeting of congresses. And there's a television network that's viewed by 60 million people around the world. Trammell Crow has been busy, and he joins us right now. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you, Dave. Good to talk to you.
That's a remarkable accomplishment in a very short period of time. And I know you're excited about this year for Earth Day and around Earth Day. You have this big Congress of conferences that's coming up and talk about all the issues, but also you're broadening out these issues. It's not just you're talking about a lot more than you did in 2010.
Well, the event actually has more subjects and verticals than any other environmental conference in the world. But I think that's because it's pro-business.
And that's the way you bring in a disparate group. That's one of the intriguing things is you've always had, you know, Republicans and Democrats and deniers and not believers all brought into the same audience.
Some people would say business is the problem. And some people would say business is the solution. And I say it's both.
So but the idea is to put everybody together. So talk about the issues that are out there right now. And in particular, my sense, and I know you're going to tell me I'm wrong, but my sense is right now there's been a pushback and that there has been some backtracking on the environment. Electric cars are not quite as fashionable as they used to be. And it seems like there's a pushback on some of the energy solutions and, you know, people advocating coal and hydrocarbons that weren't a year ago. It seems more popular to speak out against the environment rather than for it.
I think it's kind of a natural cycle of conversations, you know, coming on strong and then feedback, clawback. Technological breakthroughs are about to happen, and we just cannot slow down on hydrogen, on nuclear. We cannot. Renewable energy is not going to do it. You know, we've got to have nuclear. But there are so many mixed signals. There's this controversy on Wall Street about ESG is good, is no good. They swing back and forth. Of course, ESG is good. E is environment. G is good governance. Nobody's going to invest in a corporation that doesn't have good governance. And sustainability means saving money.
You all are, I know, talking a lot about the future of methane and natural gas. Is there a future for methane and natural gas in this country?
Of course there is. I happen to not feel quite as optimistic about that. I do think it's someday it's going to run out. We need to save our assets under the ground for future purposes that we don't even know about. But we have to get to work tomorrow, too.
You talked about the role of family offices. I've never heard of that before. Tell me about how are family offices involved in the environment?
Investments. And here in Texas, you'll talk to a family office and says, oh, I guess you're right. My wind farm is green. He's not thinking about that kind of green. He's thinking the other. The big backing on climate over the years, I would say, has come from family offices to foundations and climate groups. They are so disenchanted with the progress they've made on climate that they're funneling money back to improve the bipartisanism of our government.
Well, so is that the key, is to make the environment, right, on the one hand, the right thing to do, but also make it profitable?
It already is. And so, yes, with energy, with consumer brands, with retailers, nuclear has to happen. And it is affordable now with small modular nuclear.
Yeah.
But you were talking about the slowdowns and all these things. And I'd say it's because of government policy and not climate deniers, but just green deniers who don't realize this is the most profitable industry of the future. If you can call environment an industry, it touches urbanism, industry, circular economy, everything.
But so tell me about the people that are buying into the, like I say, you put on this enormous Congress. You've got the, who is it? You were telling me the Rotary Club is involved in this now?
The Rotary Club, with 35,000 chapters, 4 years ago made environment the seventh pillar of its work. So these are business people all over the world working on wetlands or plastic on the beaches or even climate.
So what role will they play? How do they do it? They fund it, or are they actively involved?
On a small local community basis, each chapter for its own. A young president's organization, I don't know how many committees it has on environmental matters, but a major global committee on conservation. The Boy Scouts of America must have 30 patches that are directly environment. You know that. The oil companies are going to profit by the future of energy.
Can you use technology to save the environment?
Can't happen without it. There are two ancient points of view ever since the beginning of our mess, and that's technology will save it, and the other one is just we have to scrimp and save and deprive ourselves of you know, consumption. We have to do both. Without technology, without nuclear, we're stuck. AI, I can't articulate that very well, but it'll touch every field, even the forest fires.
So what's the next big thing? What is the next thing to work on right now for you?
Well, it's energy. We're the energy capital in Texas. The oil and gas companies, I don't know if it's most or many, try to be more efficient and less polluting. The big companies do it the best. So our next move is to help turn Texas light green.
Do you do this?
If Texas turns light green, America will turn dark green.
So how do you do? Do you do this through legislation and forcing them to do it, or somehow bringing them along to the cause and showing that it's the right thing to do?
Yeah, we're still in the phase of bringing them along, exposing them, rubbing off on them. But like I say, a lot of those Republicans and Democrats would like to be able to do the right thing.
All right,
so they just don't know how. So educating them.
Well, and that takes us back to where we are, for the month of April. Third week of April, you've got people coming from all over the country, I guess all over the world, for this EarthX symposium, this Congress of Conferences. So what do we expect there? What are the issues?
Energy, circular economy, recycling. This is all cost-cutting measure. Nuclear, we'll have Susan Eisenhower. No, excuse me, we will not. We'll have Chuck Fleischman, the head of most of the nuclear subcommittees in Congress, and Brandon Williams, the only nuclear engineer in Congress, but ocean health, wildlife conservation, but innovation and technology is a big, big part of it.
Trammell Crowe is the founder of EarthX and all of the components thereof, which seem to be growing exponentially and getting ready to host the Congress of Conferences. We wish you a lot of luck. It's always fun to talk.
Thank you, Dave. Good to see you, and I'll talk to you soon.
This is Odyssey Conversations, the state of the environment. If you missed any of our discussion, search for Odyssey Conversations on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. As our conversation continues, we take a look up, way up, but don't forget your glasses. What scientists are hoping to learn from the recent solar eclipse as our Odyssey Conversations, the state of the environment, continues.
Join us at Odyssey as we all do our one thing, together millions of things, for our planet. Earth Day is April 22nd. Be sure to combine your errands and do them all in one trip, rather than making several small trips. Not only does it save gas, but it also helps to reduce wear and tear on your car in the long run. When we each share our one thing, it becomes 100 things, 1,000 things, 1,000,000 things for our planet. What's your one thing?
Baseball is in full swing. NBA playoffs are heating up, and your NFL team is gearing up for training camp. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
Welcome back to Odyssey Conversations, the state of the environment. I'm John Little, along with Kristen Diaz from Odyssey in Dallas-Fort Worth.
On April 8th, millions of people from across the world came together for one thing, to experience a rare total eclipse. A portion of 15 states were in the path of totality, and it had a profound effect on many.
It was like sheer visual poetry, and it impacts you at such a deep emotional level that it's beyond description.
It was absolutely magnificent.
Everyone goes from just cheering to just awe-inspired. You just hear the silence of everything.
We are part of an incredible gift on this planet. That's a miracle that it even exists, that we even exist. Like all the pieces that had to come together to allow for humankind to flourish on this planet, it's a miracle.
It was like life-changing. I mean, amazing.
It was really cool because, like, it was just like a once-in-a-lifetime chance.
Gave me such a sense of perspective of our place in the universe, which was both humbling and uplifting because we're part of this.
It was amazing.
It was bigger than we thought it would be.
Yes.
The temperature change, the silence, the lack of the wind.
Yeah.
She wasn't the only one who noticed the changes in the temperature and the wind. You better believe NASA scientists have been very busy researching effects of the eclipse on the environment. Some are studying how it affects the weather and what it does to the atmosphere.
Many have been using various forms of data to learn more about how eclipses impact life on Earth. Some are studying how both animals and plants reacted when their world went dark.
NASA also runs something called the GLOBE program. That's all about changes in cloud conditions and temperature. We continue Odyssey Conversations, the state of the environment, and David Rankin talks with Dr. Trina Farrell with the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center about the program.
A week ago, the country stopped for the most part as the moon came between the Earth and the sun and it eclipsed the sun's rays for a time. We got to see eclipse in 100% totality in some parts of the country, but the entire nation got a portion of it. NASA worked with a GLOBE program to look at the effects of this kind of cosmic event and its impact on the environment. We're joined by Trina Farrell. She's with NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. Trina, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
How do scientists, especially folks at NASA, take a look at eclipses that civilians like us don't?
So we did a lot with the GLOBE program that you mentioned, right? Because energy from the sun warms our planet and changes in sunlight can cause temperature, cloud, and wind changes. So with the Globe Observer app we did was, we wanted to see what would happen when the sun is blocked by the moon during the eclipse, and how would it affect the solar powered process.
That's one thing that a lot of parts of the country deal with, is that there's a lot of their grids that deal with solar power. How much of an impact did you think it would have? And I know it's kind of early to figure out how much it did have.
So it is really early. We're still analyzing the data. But for example, I did get some information. So one of the schools did participate in the Dallas area. And I think we noticed like a 2.5 degree Fahrenheit change. Analyzing a lot of this data now, so we're looking forward to getting our results back.
What kind of answers are you expecting to get back that will kind of back up the hypothesis that you have?
Right. So we're going to observe. We wanted to observe how the clouds, how the eclipse changed the atmospheric conditions near Dallas by reporting on the clouds and the air temperature. We also reported on surface temperature conditions that may have impacted the difference in the atmospheric effects in varying locations. It's a citizen science effort, right? So we could have the public help us do our scientific research.
Do eclipses typically do that with a direct impact on temperature? And as you mentioned, in cloud cover, do they, since they happen every 18 months or so?
Yes, they do make a difference in these. And that's why this app, it's helped us. It's going to help us to determine this. And so we'll hopefully have the data analyzed this summer and into the fall, and we'll have exact results. So we're quite excited, but we were so excited about that eclipse. I mean, we were worried in the morning. It looked a little cloudy. But when the time came, it was just breathtaking and amazing.
What is it about eclipses that are just so fascinating to regular people? Because more than half the country stopped to watch this. What is it fascinating for regular people and for scientists?
Right. So I think for this one, it was just so fascinating, right? Because it hit so many major cities, right? And then we started in 2017. So I think a lot of people got interested and intrigued by the one in 2017. And then now we were able to get prepared more. And then this one just hit so many major cities, the path of totality. So I just think that people just got so involved. It was just so nice to see everyone, to meet people from all over the world. It was just an amazing experience. I feel like it just brought everyone together.
Now, eclipses don't necessarily happen in this kind of a way. To have one come across the country in 2017, and again one in 2024, there was one area that was in the center of the X and got two of them at the same, one in 2017, one in 2024.
Yes.
Are they different? Are they same? Is the science even known yet?
Each one's a little different, right? Each eclipse, right, is kind of unique in its own way. So, yeah. So, but it was, it's a week later and I'm still feeling it. I'm still talking about it. I just can't believe it. It was just such an amazing thing to say. And I have to say the Dallas Arboretum for me was just like an amazing location, a wonderful venue to be at.
Tell me a little bit.
Just celebrate this amazing thing.
Tell me a little bit about the Globe Observer, the Globe program.
So it stands for Global Learning Observations to Benefit the Environment. So it's so we actually turn the app on during the eclipse so we can take these measurements. But when the app is not turned on, there's other things that you can, for the eclipse, there's other things that you can do. You can look at clouds, tree height, land cover, and even mosquito larvae. Yes, I know you're like, mosquito larvae, it seems kind of weird. But yeah, you can buy a fairly inexpensive microscope and you can attach it to your phone. And you can actually look at standing water that's in your area. So it's a pretty cool app, and it allows the public to help us do citizen science efforts. And it's also, Globe is just a unique program as well, I think, right? There's got amazing environmental protocols that you can do. For educators, it's nice because you can do these protocols within an hour, within your class period. You don't need expensive equipment to do some of the protocols. And so overall, I just think it's a great program.
You talk about citizen scientists. How important is that to moving the path of science forward?
It's important because we want to see what's going on in people's areas, right? Where you live. And so who better knows where you live than you? And so that helps our scientists to know what's going on. And it's a great way to get like our young scientists involved, right? Younger students involved, right? Because they're going to be our future. So it's a great way to go out. It's a great way to have families get involved. You can take your kids outside, enjoy the environment and also do science. So
let's talk about how the citizen scientists can impact the environment. How does that work?
You can impact the environment by giving us the data. Helping us to support different challenges that we have with the Globe Observer app, doing the protocols, reporting back the information. And the cool thing about a lot of these protocols, especially with the Globe program, is there's already like things are already set up. Like if you're an educator, basically all the lessons are already done for you. You kind of just have to, you know, Xerox the worksheets and do the science and then give it back to us. So a lot of stuff's already, a lot of the pre-work is already done for you.
So what happens next for the GLOBE program? What happens now that the eclipse is over and you're analyzing the data? Obviously, you're looking forward to the next thing, which would be what?
So the next, well, we're going to keep, we turn this on again for eclipses, right? So we've got some other eclipses coming up in 2026. So we'll probably, we'll turn it back on again. So that's it. So we'll keep going and then just, you know, keep, we're going to analyze this data. We'll probably do a report about it. And so we're going to keep going on our end.
Welcome back to Odyssey Conversations, the state of the environment. I'm Kristen Diaz, along with John Little from Odyssey in Dallas-Fort Worth.
Odyssey's Austin York talks to one energy expert about the pros and cons of solar as a renewable energy source, as our Odyssey conversation, State of the Environment, continues.
There's a tremendous push for states to expand their use of renewable energy sources to power their electric grids. And one of those sources is solar panels. I'm Austin York with KRLD, and I spoke with Energy Fellow Ed Herz with the University of Houston about the benefits of solar, the cost, and possible drawbacks to the technology.
Well, in many regions of the country, electricity is irregular, unreliable, and expensive. And so I'm thinking in particular of, say, of California. And so rooftop solar has been a tremendous boon in California. For those residents who can absolutely detach it from the grid, they've been able to maintain power while their grid has suffered failures due to earthquakes or storms or the massive fires that they had in 2020. The growth that we're seeing in places such as Texas, utility scale solar, so these would be the big solar farms, have been jumping into the Texas grid such that Texas now produces more solar and wind as a renewable electricity resource than any state in the nation. Anything with solar or wind benefits from the fact that there's no fuel cost. And we know that oil, natural gas, LNG, and coal have a significant cost of fuel. Some of these have very significant cost of environmental liabilities. And so the renewables have been benefiting from tax breaks, low property taxes, direct subsidies, the production tax credit from the federal government to make their operating costs go down.
You've spoken about the benefits. What are some of the drawbacks to solar panels?
You know, for example, if we were to replace a 1,000 megawatt natural gas-fired power plant completely with solar, then we would need at least two 1,000 megawatt solar farms. Each one taking 15 to 18,000 acres of land. We'd need two because, of course, one would supply power during the day. The other would charge battery packs to be operated during the night. If it's a 12-hour day, then there would be three battery packs, each one at the technological maximum of 4 hours of discharge each. If it's an eight-hour day, which, of course, we'd face during the winter, we'd need another solar farm and yet another battery pack. So, say, a $1 billion natural gas power plant would have to be replaced by at least $7 billion of solar farms and battery packs.
So could solar panels actually be having a more detrimental effect on the environment due to the lack of battery resources than has been so universally advertised?
Battery technology is advancing rapidly. I don't think that the batteries that we have today are going to be the ones that we have 5 years from now or 10 years from now. Certainly, these come with a cost. We're using rare earths. We're using a lot of cobalt. We're using lithium salts. There are developments in the laboratories where solid-state batteries are working or slurries of hydrogen and magnesium, other such avenues for either electrochemical storage or even just gravity storage of electricity, potentially we'll get a breakthrough there.
We've got so much sun in places like Texas here that we think, can we just harness this power? It sounds like a great idea, but is it feasible?
The issue, of course, is the cost and how does it get paid for? And with the Inflation Reduction Act, a little bit misnamed there, but what we're doing is beginning to pay for most of this with the taxpayer. The amount of money that goes has got to be 7 to 1, if you will, going with my example. But and that, of course, assumes the sun shines all the time and, you know, there are no interruptions and everything's efficient. And by the way, we'll have to add in the cost of new transmission lines because nobody can build solar farms in urban areas, which is where the consumers are located. The cost and cost recovery from this is going to come either out of the consumer pocket or the taxpayer pocket, but it's coming out of the same pair of pants. It's just a question of how we finance it. Are we going to finance it on the national credit card, or are we going to finance it individually with higher electricity rates at home?
All right, let's say we are fine with the costs. Does the country actually have the infrastructure in place to support this kind of energy source?
This is going to be a massive undertaking. We've already seen areas, for example, in West Texas, where we have a lot of wind farms and a number of new solar farms, where they have been shut out of the market due to a lack of transmission lines to the consuming regions of the state. We need to build more transmission lines to get that electricity to Dallas, to Austin, to Houston. And we're seeing some of that in California as well. And so the way that's reflected in the grid markets, that would be a so-called congestion charge when they have to shut off the resource coming from a wind farm or solar farm and then pay somebody else to provide that electricity in a consumer region. You know, ordinarily, we located the coal plants and the natural gas-fired power plants closer to the consumer regions. Those are the marginal plants that get turned on today as the grid ramps up with demand each day.
I mentioned earlier about Texas having lots of sun. You mentioned California, another state with lots of sun. But in regions of the country like the Northeast, New England, for example, maybe not so much.
You know, I'm certain that we will have a lot more solar development, you know, in the southern states than we will in the northern states. The efficiency is just too great. It's a matter of you know, proximity to the sun and the equator. Those cities in the Northeast, for example, Boston, the mayor a few years ago said he would be all solar, all wind. You know, that's not going to be feasible without some incredible transmission lines dragging that power out of the producing regions up to the Northeast. We don't have the technology for that just yet. You know, in Boston, for example, is dependent upon LNG to provide its natural gas heating and also to top off its electricity supply during the winter. So some of these states have gotten ahead of themselves by retiring hydroelectric too soon, retiring nuclear power plants too soon. They are going to be feeling the transition a lot more than, for example, the southern states will.
All right, this is going to be a massive undertaking. We know the cost and the batteries and infrastructure problems, but this is still a very important energy source to continue to develop, right?
Yes, I think that solar is certainly going to be a tremendous component of electricity supply in the future, along with wind. If we can get a breakthrough with nuclear fusion or some of the small modular reactors, perhaps, nuclear will again grow and become a larger portion of our electricity supply going forward. Solar doesn't bring with it the hazards of nuclear power or spent fuel. It just requires an awful lot of land and not a whole lot of technology at this point. The cost of panels, they're manufactured in China primarily, has been going down and it looks to be cheapening and with improved performance going forward. The technological development is such that it's it's going to be here for a long time. The question that we face as society is, are we going to be able to maintain reliability going forward? California retired nuclear plants and natural gas and coal plants too quickly, and so ran into a huge reliability issue over the last several years. Texas similarly developed a market model that does not pay natural gas plants to stay on the grid or build new ones. And in the face of a really expanding population, we haven't seen new fossil fuel plants added to the Texas grid. There are more than a million people in Texas now following that freeze in 2021, and no significant number of new power plants have been added. And so the supply is being made up by the renewable fleet. It suffers from intermittency, and the battery packages really haven't caught up with the growth in population and economic demand.
That was Energy Fellow Ed Herz with the University of Houston. I'm Austin York.
You've been listening to Odyssey Conversations, the state of the environment. It's a never-ending conversation on an important topic that continues to change. Some say for the better, others say for the worse. However you feel, we hope we gave you a deeper insight on some of the topics that affect us and the world around us.
And a reminder, just in case you missed any of this special program, you can find it when you search for Odyssey Conversations on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Kristen Diaz with John Little at Odyssey Dallas-Fort Worth. We'll see you again for the next Odyssey Conversations.
Baseball is in full swing. NBA playoffs are heating up, and your NFL team is gearing up for training camp. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.